And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matuta.
And welcome, everybody. Hands on Apologetics. I am Gary Matuta, and you have just entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo. And it's great to be with you. And boy, coming off the holiday weekend, I don't know about you, but it's tough to get back into the swing of things. It's I don't know if my brain has caught up with my body yet. So nevertheless, we will persevere in talking about some of the most important things that anybody can talk about, namely how to share, explain, defend the Catholic faith with charity, clarity, and confidence. And, you know, as always, I try to give you the best tools and the best guests. In fact, today's guest is an awesome guest we've had on once before. His name is Patrick Flynn, Pat Flynn from the Pat Flynn Show. A very interesting guy. He is a revert to the Catholic faith, but his claim to fame is actually is an author in basically teaching an idea of generalism, which is a way that people can succeed at pretty much anything. I mean, it's just basic life principle. He's a life coach, essentially. He's also a weightlifter, a musician, all sorts of good stuff. And when he was on the show, I think it was a few weeks ago, Pat Flynn shared with us his own journey of faith. And as you know, he lost his faith in God, and he was a studied atheist for a good part of his life. And it was really through him working through all the arguments in atheism and looking at proofs for the existence of God that he came to believe that God does, in fact, exist. And then he worked his way to Christianity, eventually Catholicism. And so it's a really cool journey of faith. Check it out, folks. It was in August. And today we're going to kind of pick up the story a little bit. And he's going to share with us what exactly was it that convinced them that God exists? You know, what kind of proofs out there did he find persuasive? So I'm looking forward to chatting with Pat Flynn on the other side of the break. Good stuff. Can't wait. Also, as always, we have our exercises to sharpen our critical thinking skills, and we have a finding the fallacy, which is for today, the fallacy of composition. Okay, fallacy of composition. That's a fun one. You know, it's the opposite of the fallacy of division for those fans out there that love, informal fallacies. And as always, we meet one of the early church fathers, and today's early church father is a interesting one in that he became an anti-pope. And that is none other than Novation. So interesting story about him. So we got cool stuff as far as finding the fallacy, cool stuff as far as meeting the early church fathers, and really cool stuff when Mr. Flynn comes on the show. So good stuff all around. As always, you are part of the show. So if you want to give us a call, maybe you'll have a question for Pat, give us a call at 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. Or you can always email us at questions@handsonapologetics.com. And as always, we want to give a shout out to those watching on our social media section of the dojo on Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. I hope everybody had a great weekend. It's good to see familiar names. And thank you. Appreciate it, Beth. And I want to say hello to all of you listening on Catholic radio and also via podcast. And I usually mention this, but it's important. It's a really great website you need to go to, and that is virginmostpowerfulradio.org. That is the flagship website for Virgin Most Powerful Radio. And that way you can download, listen to all the great programs, not only Hands-On Apologetics, but Jesus 911, Terry and Jesse. All the great shows are there on the website. And also, by the way, if you don't know about this, you can also listen to us via phone app, Virgin Most Powerful phone app, which has lots of free goodies. And if you're a listener to the show, you know that I like free goodies. So try to plug you into free resources. That's a good resource to have on your iPhone or other devices. All right, so why don't we jump into our finding the fallacy for today? And like I said, the fallacy is the fallacy of composition. What is the fallacy of composition, you ask? Well, let me answer. It arises when one infers that something is true for the whole from the fact that it's true for the parts, okay? And perhaps even every part. For example, you know, this is a classic one. If you were to take an airplane, you know, not a 747, but like a Piper Cub or some small airplane, tear it down to nuts and bolts pieces, you could lift probably every single part of the engine, you know, some of the airplane. Now, some of them may be pretty heavy, but nevertheless, they're all liftable. Okay. Now, it would be wrong for you to infer that the airplane can be lifted since all its parts can be lifted. Okay, so that would commit the fallacy of composition. So you could say this tire is made of rubber, therefore the entire vehicle must be made rubber. That's another fallacy of composition. And what it does is it reasons that something must be true of the whole because it's true of the part. Okay. By the way, division is the opposite. The fallacy of division argues that something is true for the parts because it's true for the whole. Okay, so it just flips it around. So, you know, the cool thing with this is a twofer, folks. So if you can grasp the fallacy of composition, then you also grasp at the same time its opposite, the fallacy of division. All right, good stuff. Good to know, right? All right, so why don't we jump into the Meet the Early Fathers segment. Like I said, our early father for today is Novatian, who was anti-pope, who reigned from 251 to 258. And I'll tell you what an anti-pope is in a little bit. We first meet Novatian, which, by the way, the correct form of his name is Novatus, about the year 250 AD. He was a priest of great prominence among the clergy in Rome. In fact, two letters addressed by the clergy to Cyprian of Carthage. Last week we talked about him. He was one of the Meet the Early Church Fathers folks. The great Cyprian in North Africa, well, guess what? Two of those letters that were written to him from the Roman clergy were signed. This is, by the way, was during the vacancy of the election of Pope St. Cornelius. Two of these letters were written by Novatian in the name of his confreres. So that tells us that Novatian, at least at this time, was very popular, perhaps a very influential person in Rome, while we're waiting to elect the next pope. And no doubt that Novatian hoped to be the Bishop of Rome, to be pope himself. At any rate, when Cornelius was elected in March of the year 251, he started showing some attitude of leniency towards those who lapsed. Novatian suddenly reversed his own lenient views and became a rigorist. So during the periods of Roman persecution, after the persecution was lifted, there was the problem of what do you do with Christians who forsake the faith, they lapsed, and then after the persecution, they want to come back to the church. What do you do? Well, there were two views. One was lenient, namely that they needed to do confession and a very long penance, but they should be readmitted. And then there was the rigorous view, which was like, tell them to take a hike. Or make it so extremely hard that maybe on their deathbed they can come back to the church. So anyway, Novatian kind of flips from the lenient view to the rigorous view. And according to Eusebius, he was found three guiltless bishops from a remote part of Italy whom he plied with wine until they no longer were in the right senses. And he succeeded in them to consecrate him bishop. And that was around the year 250. This, therefore, made him what is known as an antipope. The antipope is not necessarily somebody who is, has different views than the Holy Father. An antipope means that someone who illegitimately is elected as pope while there is a legitimate current pope. So he's the antipope. And in fact, from Novatian comes a sect, a heretical sect known as the Novatianist. I know. Who would have thought that they would be called Novatianist? By the way, the Novatianists were basically spread with some success into Spain, into the East, and also to Syria in the West. So Novation is kind of spread all over Christendom at this time. Let's see. In fact, it remained in Syria for a few centuries. Now, what were the Novatius? What was the cause of the schism? Well, besides the fact that Novatus, you know, their founder, was an anti-pope. The funny thing is that the Novatians really didn't differ on doctrinal matters too much. Really, all they differed on was their insistence upon being rigorous in their practices. Not only for the lapsed, you know, not only did they want the lapsed to jump through so many hoops and maybe you could possibly come into the church, but then again, maybe not. But they also forbade, for example, entirely second marriages. So if you were lawfully married and your spouse dies, they would say you're not allowed to marry again. They also refused absolutely any reconciliation with those whom lapsed from the faith. So basically, even after all those penance and stuff, you couldn't come back in. So that was the Novationist schism. And all this comes from our Meet the Early Church Father for today, who is Novatus, or better known as Novation, who reigned as anti-pope between AD 251 and AD 258. So, good stuff. It's always fascinating to, you know, learn about these early church fathers. You know, how many times do you, over a coffee table, do you talk about anti-popes? Well, now you can. All right, coming up on the other side of the break, Master Apologist Pat Flynn's going to come on. We're going to talk about proving the existence of God. So, lots of great stuff in store. You listen to Hands On Apologetics. I'm Gary Machuda. We'll be right back.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
In Luke 7, Jesus said, "I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven her, because she has been shown great love." According to St. John of the Cross, Christians should always remember that the value of their good works is not based on number and excellence. Their value is based on the love for God that prompts them to do the works. May we always be motivated by true love for God, and not worry so much about what we do, but why we do it.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody, Hands-On Apologetics. And we're going to talk about the existence of God. Can you know it? Can you prove it? If someone said, "I don't know if God exists," would you be able to give a good explanation as to why you believe God exists. Well, you know, there's a lot of people out there that have become atheists, and some of them kind of dabble, and you know, some have reasons that aren't necessarily intellectual, but there are people who did study and did refuse to believe God exists, but nevertheless, the study sometimes leads them back to not only the existence of God, but also to Christianity and to the faith. Actually, Mr. Engineer, do we have our guest ready? I just want to...
Can you hear me?
Ah, there you go. Okay. Well, good. I wasn't sure. So our guest will help us kind of walk through that, because he kind of journeyed through those same questions, and that is Pat Flynn of The Pat Flynn Show, which is an amazingly successful and interesting podcast ministry that involves everything from fitness to mental health to business to writing to philosophy to theology. He's a best-selling author, philosopher, fitness coach, musician, entrepreneur, and he also expounds upon the theory of generalism, which is a theory applicable to each and every one of us. And by the way, you can check out all the great stuff Pat Flynn has produced at his website, which is chroniclesofstrength.com. All one word, chroniclesofstrength.com. And Pat Flynn, welcome to Hands-On Apologetics.
Gary, it is always a pleasure to be talking with you. Thanks for having me on again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I wasn't sure. I didn't get a thumbs up. Usually the engineer will say, hey, the guest is ready. And so I'm glad you're on.
That may have been my fault. Apologies for that.
Oh, no. Not necessary. But, you know, I got to have you on maybe in a future program to talk about this theory of generalism.
Oh, yeah, I'd certainly be happy to. I mean, it really just comes down to the admission that I was never quite as great at any one thing as I wanted to be. So I just had to settle with trying to get good, or at least fairly competent, at a number of different things, and then see if I could stack those skills in some way to form a special message or competitive advantage that way. And that's generally been my approach ever since.
Nice. Yeah, that would be a fascinating subject. We'll have to do that. I'm going to put that into the old dojo notebook here.
Yeah, talk cool. About no, generalism. My pleasure. And I think there is a certain applicability to apologetics there. There could be a nice tie, and I'd enjoy exploring that with you.
Absolutely. So yeah, you know, like my interest, my intro. Boy, my brain is on half wattage today. My intro's talked about, existence of God. Struggling with, does he exist? Doesn't he exist? Now, when you shared your journey of faith, you're one of those persons that really dug into the issue. I mean, you weren't a dabbler in terms of that big question.
Yeah, that's right. I had a fairly early introduction to skepticism, and not to repeat too much of the story, but in high school, I encountered a lot of the old atheists and existentialists, and that really colored my worldview for many, many years. And I think I gave the account of how it was really atheism itself that caused me to consider religious claims, because I kept running into just various conclusions and consequences that certainly were emotionally difficult to accept, but I would say even became logically unacceptable as well. Problems of consciousness, of reason, of morality. So it was really by going deeper into atheism that the whole worldview really just kind of collapsed like a cheap cardboard house. And then once that happens, it's kind of interesting, because it's kind of like a negative apologetic. Once you kind of get to a point where you realize, well, this just cannot possibly be true. Well, there's really only one alternative left, and that's at least some type of general theism. Now, maybe it's a pantheism, maybe it's monotheism in the tradition of classical theism. But, you know, reality can only kind of be one of two ways: either God or gods exist, or no God or no gods exist. So really, once my atheism had sort of run out of its logical rope, that really kind of led me by default to accepting, okay, I think there might be something more to reality than just physical things. So it's kind of an interesting, I didn't have some like deep mystical experience, or, you know, I didn't like meet God on the top of a mountain or anything like that. It was really by just trying to establish an atheistic worldview that I eventually led to just rejecting the entire project.
Now that's interesting, because Do you think, there's many atheists out there that hadn't come to that point where they see that their philosophy is incompatible with experience or, you know, what we know. Why do you suppose they never reached that point or haven't reached that point?
I have my speculations, and unfortunately I haven't got to talk to too many committed, say, eliminativists. But I like the eliminativist position, and these would be people who really accept a lot of the things that I think atheism entails. They would accept that if only physical things exist, you really can't explain consciousness, for example, or you really can't explain morality. So what we're going to do is we're just going to take the nuclear option, and we're just going to say that none of these things even do exist.
Right.
And I like it because there's a certain consistency there. But to your point, Gary, there also seems to be a deep incoherency because, I mean, as sure as anything, it seems like I exist. And you always have that kind of classic conundrum where it's hard to deny your own existence because you need somebody to issue the denial. It's hard to say it's an illusion because you still need that subjective sense of having an illusion. So you kind of get into this vicious circularity with it. So I don't know. I don't have an answer for why people will really accept what seems to me to be a clear absurdity. But I will congratulate them at the same time, because this is a camp. It's not just theists who make these claims, and I think it's important for people to realize it. There's many atheists, prominent academic atheists, who really do argue just these very things. If reality is just physical, then we have no way to explain consciousness, morality, what have you. So we're just going to push them off the table. They don't really exist.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat as you, because I do see that as a kind of muscular intellectualism that you're willing to go down with the ship, because that is what reason points to.
Yeah, I mean, so you tell me, like, why do you think? Just such a deeply ingrained prejudice or bias against a religious or theistic worldview. I don't know, and I hesitate to speculate on it because I don't want to misjudge or mischaracterize somebody. But it is curious, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Yeah, and you're right. And probably every individual has their own reason. I don't know. Sometimes when you see where the train is headed, there's something in us that kind of recoils and prefers more fuzzy. Let's just stop here. I don't want to go where the train ends.
And that seems to be a lot of the contemporary new atheists, at least some of the time. They want to kind of have their atheistic cake and eat it too, and they don't really want to drive to a lot of the conclusions that certainly many of the old atheists and absurdists and nihilists were willing to accept. So it's in the kind of contemporary scene, at least on the popular level, what I find is it's a very superficial atheism, very superficial. And they try to make it a lot more attractive than it inherently is. And so even when I was a very skeptical person, it was hard for me to take a lot of the sort of popular level new atheists very seriously, because I just did not see them as being very consistent with the position. I enjoyed the people who were consistent with the position, but because of them, I ultimately came to reject it.
Yeah, that's true. And I have a feeling a lot of old school atheists do kind of look down their nose at some of the popular, new atheism, so to speak. But okay, so you came to the conviction, well, this worldview, with these propositions just doesn't ring out. So, I'm going to look at theism. What was your first step? Where did you go?
Yeah, it was with the classical philosophers. So I went back to Plato and Aristotle, and I studied them for a while, and they obviously had some very interesting ideas. And this is where I started to think about things like the problem of universals very seriously, of what does that really say about reality, and universals being our ability to grasp, abstract objects and propositions and mathematics, things like triangularity or greenness or dogness. And you're like, how do we explain that? And it doesn't seem like physicalism is a very good explanation, because anything physical or material is always like a very particular instance. There's this triangle or there's that triangle. But it doesn't seem like we ever encounter in the material world triangularity as such. And Plato thought about this in a very interesting way. And he, of course, posited his famous Platonic heaven, right? The realm of the forms, that there existed this sort of third realm were these eternal and unchanging forms, which we all sort of participate in. You know, they exist, you know, abstractly. And then there's this demiurge, right? This sort of lowercase g god that looks to the forms and then kind of fashions the material world down below. I thought that was interesting, but it was also unsatisfying. I felt, first off, I don't think that there's a demiurge out there. But the funny thing is, though, is it's just kind of a side note, is it does seem like when a lot of the new atheists and skeptics make critiques of God, it seems like they're almost critiquing a demiurge type of figure, right? Like not like God in classical theism, like as the ground of being, as existence itself, but rather just some like very big being, some very large entity that's like kind of in charge of putting things together. Fair enough. Like to some extent, I think those criticisms would have force if I was arguing for Plato's demiurge, but I'm not.
Right.
But I think it is an interesting note, and I think it's important to draw those distinctions. But Plato was appealed to me because there was something to that. There was something to the idea of, okay, it seems like our intellects can really grasp something that cannot be reduced to the purely physical. This problem of the universals as it come to be known. And then actually fast forwarding, I found Augustine who kind of explained what seemed to me a very plausible account of this, and that he more or less argued that what Plato considered the realm of forms was just the mind of God. That's the and that an eternal act of understanding was probably the simplest and best way to explain what Plato thought existed just abstractly. And not to get too far into the weeds of this argument, but that seems correct to me. At least it seemed plausible and got me intrigued, because how you could exist or how you could explain the idea of abstract objects existing apart from minds to begin with never really made sense to me. That's why I never became a full-blown Platonist. But it did seem like you could make sense of it if you had at the foundation of reality some eternally existing mind. So rather than God as a sort of middleman, God is that ultimate foundation to explain at least certain phenomena like the problem of universal. So that was kind of an initial first step. And Plato and Aristotle were very interesting in that regard, and kind of just got me thinking and becoming open to the idea of maybe mind is the foundation. Maybe it isn't all just matter and motion after all. I went down that road and it didn't seem to pan out quite as well as I had hoped.
That's great. Yeah. Well, let's hold it there. We'll come back. We're talking with Pat Flynn, the Pat Flynn Show, ChroniclesOfStrength.com, folks, if you want to check it out. And we got a lot more on the other side of the break, so stay tuned.
Hi, this is Barbara Nicolosi, and we're having a women's conference here at the Sacred Heart Chapel in Covina on September 7th, 2019. This is going to be a great, great day for you to come and meet a bunch of new friends, wonderful Catholic women who want to deepen their Catholic faith and their understanding of themselves as women. You know, this era right now that we're in, so much confusion. What is it to be a man? What is it to be a woman? You know, the Catholic Church has a lot to say about this, and we're going to hear about them. We're going to hear about John Paul II's letter on women that he wrote from Mary Danielle Barber. She's going to talk about that. She's going to talk about Mary as a model for all of us. It's a topic that we can never reflect on too much. I'm going to talk about Teresa of Avila and the interior castle and how a mystical marriage is what all of us should be called to or are called to as Catholics in our prayer lives, and especially as women in the church. Aileen Blakowski is going to talk about motherhood and homeschooling. And then finally, we have Father Charles Murray. He's going to be the celebrant of the Eucharist. He's going to be here hearing confessions. It's going to be an amazing day. We're going to have an hour of adoration together, time to pray, time to laugh, eat, reflect, grow in our passion for our Catholic faith and our identity as Catholic women. You don't want to miss it. You want to come. You want to bring your friends. You want to bring your daughters, your nieces. That's really an affordable day. So go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org and you can register for this conference or call 877-526-2151. The Women's Conference is going to be a great event for the Archdiocese of Los Angeles area, Southern California Catholics. You don't want to miss it.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics. We are with our master apologist, Pat Flynn, and we're talking about the existence of God. And right by the end of the break, Pat, you're talking about abstract objects and how, you know, Plato understood these abstractions to be in the, you know, this third realm or other realm, and then how Augustine saw it as the abstracts are in the mind of God. And actually, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but Michael Agros has a great exercise to demonstrate what an abstract object is. He tells his students to pull out a piece of paper and draw as many different triangles as he can. I don't know if you're familiar with this.
No.
You know, isosceles, right triangle, any big, small, red, green, whatever. And then, you know, after a couple of minutes, he says, okay, now I want you to draw triangularity. And, of course, you know, they try to think about how to do it, and they give up. And he said, you know, that's a perfect – I think it's a great way to show, like, abstracts just aren't physical. You can't draw them. You can, the best you can do is put a name on it that points to that idea.
Yeah, and that's the key, isn't it? It really is an idea. So grounding this, you know, it kind of comes back to the idea of physicalism is whatever the foundation of reality is, does it have the equipment to explain the experiences that we have, right? Does it have the equipment to explain abstract propositions? Does it have the equipment to explain consciousness? Does it have the equipment to explain morality? And the answer consistently seems to be no. It really can't explain these things. It has to rather explain away these things. And I always found that to be deeply unsatisfying. But as I studied the tradition of classical theism, and you really kind of see God as this unrestricted act of understanding at the foundation of reality, well, now it seems like we do have the equipment, at least in some capacity, to explain how other beings have minds, how we can come into contact or come to know of abstract objects, propositions, mathematics, how we can, you know, reason according to certain principles, how we can perceive an objective moral law. All these things at least now seem to have a plausible foundation. Maybe we don't know exactly the details of how all of them worked out. But it at least now seems conceivable and plausible. And that was kind of something that really initially attracted me to want to study natural theology more and the great, theistic tradition, specifically as it has kind of come up throughout Catholic history.
Yeah. Yeah. Did it strike you as odd that, creation seems to be written, it's a book written with abstracts, you know, abstract objects and stuff. And yet we know the language of the book. You know, how is it that we have the language to read it?
Absolutely. I mean, that's something that some of the eliminativists will even argue against that, right? They'll say that there is no such thing as meaning. But then it's like, well, then how did I just understand that stupid statement?
Yeah, well put. So is that a meaningless statement that you just made?
Yeah, like I obviously have to understand what you're saying to disagree with it, which I strongly do. Therefore, it's just one of those many positions again that it seems like atheism draws you into that ultimately should cause you, I would argue, should cause you to reject atheism rather than you just digging your heels in and saying, nope, this is just what it is.
Yeah, that's great. You know, it's funny. I didn't expect you to go to, abstract objects and Augustine. I thought that the first place you would go to is something from Aristotle, like the unmoved mover or something like
that. Yeah, well, that was actually my next step. So if we're just kind of tracing my personal history here, which may be wildly uninteresting to people, this was just kind of the course of how I proceeded and began to think about things. And of course, in my first, kind of years of philosophy class, we studied Plato. But for whatever reason, I either didn't pay attention to the problem of universals, or we just spent too much time caricaturing God by lobbing out the Euthyphro dilemma. So if anything else, I initially saw Plato as kind of like giving an objection to God on moral grounds. When I later revisited him a lot more seriously, then I said, no, Plato is giving some good arguments here, or at least some interesting arguments that I want to pursue further. So yeah, this was just kind of how I proceeded.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, when I took Intro to Philosophy, it was, Euthyphro, and then it's, okay, now let's talk about the Republic. And that was pretty much it for Plato,
That's it. Yeah, that's your typical Intro to Philosophy course. And for those who are unfamiliar, the Euthyphro dilemma is, do the gods will something because it's good, or is something good because the gods will it? And obviously, neither of these are, satisfying to any believer. He says gods, but it's been lobbed at, of course, God, capital G, sure. Now. And the correct response is that is no, something is issued from God's nature, which is itself the very center of oughtness and goodness. So it's kind of a false dilemma, right, is the way that it's presented. We can go between the horns and say God stands as that objective reference point of absolute goodness and moral perfection, which, interestingly enough, in my Intro to Philosophy courses, nobody ever considered that it might be a false dilemma, right? We're just
yeah. Well, those intro courses, I think the professors just they don't want to give the answers. They just want you to be troubled by it, so you'll take the next course, and hopefully get some answers.
Yeah. I wish I could be that charitable, but I don't think that – I think my professor was genuinely persuaded that this was a good argument. And for whatever reason – and I think this is common in – I went to a secular university, not a Catholic one, so I think it's pretty common for – a lot of philosophers who are atheists to often just kind of pass along their stock objections one to another and never really go too much outside and see, has any theist ever really considered this? As it happens, for how old this objection is, yes, many have, believe it or not. There are responses to the Euthyphro dilemma.
Right. Yeah, very good. So, okay, so you came to the conviction that there's this mind, immaterial mind out there. What was your next step?
Yeah, so you brought up Aristotle and his unmoved mover, and that was very interesting to me. And I have to be perfectly honest, when I first came across these arguments, it wasn't like they convinced me right away in any direction. They got me interested, I think is the best way to say it. They got me wanting to know more and study deeper. So, Aristotle in Metaphysics argues for this unmoved mover. He says, hey, things are changing. Change is the reduction of a potential state to an actual state. This is a kind of a broad metaphysical principle. This cannot lend itself to an infinite regress. Therefore, the buck has to stop somewhere. And we would say that it stops at that which is purely actual, which has no potentiality. So it's just this kind of eternal, perfectly existing foundation to reality that is the power behind all powers. And this was really kind of my first step to the God of the philosophers, as it's called. And I think it's a great argument. I really do, especially as I continued to pursue it through Aquinas. This is, of course, what Aquinas takes as his famous first way, and then reading a lot of the contemporary thinkers on this, people like Brian Davies or Ed Fazer, guests like you've had on your show who've done really good work on this. The more I studied this argument, I was like, wow, there's really some force behind this. This is at very least an argument worthy of serious consideration, and the more I considered it, the more I came to see, I think that this is correct. So I'm glad you brought up Aristotle, because he was kind of a significant step for me. I kind of wanted to trace the line of the classic and medieval philosophers from Plato, Aristotle, Boethius, Augustine, Aquinas, and so on. Yeah. And that was the big contribution from Aristotle. Aside, of course, from his ethics as well, virtue ethics. And it was also really important, because I was always deeply intrigued in moral philosophy as well, and the whole idea of traditional natural law. Is one of the big reasons, one of the many big reasons I began to consider the Catholic Church, which has always affirmed traditional natural moral law. And for many reasons, I would always avoid the Catholic Church because I thought it was so archaic and immoral from a secular perspective. But the deeper I began to study morality and ethics, the more I kept kind of edging towards the Catholic Church. So it was kind of a bunch of – it was more of a confluence or convergence of many different arguments and perspectives that eventually kind of landed me into Catholicism. But Aristotle was another big one.
Yeah. Well, you know, for those who aren't familiar with it, what is a natural law, a natural moral law?
Yeah, so traditional natural law kind of stands atop two philosophical foundations. One is essentialism, which is the idea that there really are essences to be discovered in the world. There really are natures. So there's a such thing as human nature, for example, or squirrel nature, or dog nature, or tree nature, or substantial forms is another way of putting it. So that's one pillar. And the other pillar is teleology, is that sort of inherent to these natures, there's a certain directedness or aim towards their inherent flourishing. And once you can argue for those two pillars, which I think you can successfully do, you can then deduce from the sort of essences and aims of things what they are inherently directed at, and then know thereby what is inherently good or bad for certain things. Now, in a lot of respects, if we're talking about like the essence of an acorn being directed to an oak tree, we're not talking in a moral dimension. We're just saying, hey, it's good for an acorn to become an oak tree because that's what it's directed at by its very nature. When we get to human nature, because we have intellects and wills, then the moral dimension comes in, right? Because we can make choices. But it's no less different for us. Like, there is a human nature. We are directed at, as Catholics, we would ultimately believe the beatific vision, eternal friendship with God. So whatever promotes that proper end to us, that is a good act. That is a morally upright act. Whatever frustrates that, whatever sort of interferes with our proper end of attaining that eternal state of happiness with God, is an immoral act. And you can unpack, an entire system of ethics from this. And I would argue it is really the only philosophically consistent and coherent ethical package out there. And it was kind of going through all the other ethical philosophies, deontology, utilitarianism, et cetera, until I finally got to natural law that I felt like I was getting some intellectually satisfying answers to serious ethical questions.
So is it possible to be an atheist and hold on to natural law?
Some say yes. Some say if you're an atheist who can at least affirm essentialism and teleology, which some do, then you can make the case for natural law. But as others would argue, is that you still need God to kind of uphold that entire system, that you, especially as kind of an ultimate authority over the system of, so what if I don't want to fulfill my own, you know, nature or purpose, right? But also as an explanation to how things or why things have essences or forms anyways, on a deeper metaphysical level, that is going to get you to God. So I would say you can kind of draw the line as an atheist, but I would argue it would be at best arbitrary. And without that ultimate explanation or foundation in God, the natural law project collapses. However, just as an epistemological project, you don't need to make direct reference to God. And I think that's an important distinction.
Okay, great. We're talking with Pat Flynn about proving the existence of God. Stay tuned, folks. More on the other side of the break.
Welcome, Daniel. You're on the line. What's on your mind, brother?
Hi, I just wanted to share a testimony about Virgin Most Powerful Radio. I had a buddy at work who, you know, he's a lukewarm Catholic guy, and I wanted him to start listening to the Terry and Jesse show, so I kept telling him to download the app, and he kept putting me off. So one day, I grabbed his phone, and I downloaded the app for him. I went on vacation, and you know, I kept telling him to listen to it. He was kind of put me off. I came back from vacation. He comes to my cubicle and he says to me, "Hey, man, I've been listening to Terry and Justin's show and it's great. And it's made a big impact in his life. The guy, he's going to weekly adoration a couple times a
wow.
week. He goes to the mass in the morning. Mm-hmm. He's an on fire Catholic and he promotes the Terry and Jesse show and the Virgin Most Powerful Radio."
Wow. Daniel, what a testimony. And I want to encourage our listeners to get those cards by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org and do what Daniel's doing. Go out and spread the faith by inviting people to listen to Virgin Most Powerful. Daniel, thanks for your testimony, brother. God love you.
You're welcome.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity. Be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show. And they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody, to Hands-On Apologetics. We are chatting with the Chronicles of Strength guy himself, Pat Flynn, of the Pat Flynn Show, and talk about, you know, how he kind of came to grips with theism and understand God does exist. And we talked about abstractions, you know, and pointing to the mind of God and Aristotle and natural law. And, you know, it's interesting, Pat, that now you're, you know, as you're going through this, you start seeing these pointers, you know, beyond the question of whether God exists to, you know, well, who else holds on to natural law morality, you know?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I was very hesitant at first, as I said in our last conversation, you know, when you kind of are steeped in a heavy broth of secularism from a young age. I mean, nothing kind of becomes more of your worst enemy than that yeah. Dreadful Catholic Church. Right.
Yeah. So, ABC, anything but Catholic.
Yeah. I mean, my wife is a convert as well. I always tease her because there was at one point where she says, okay, I'll consider Christianity, but no way in hell am I ever becoming Catholic. and she was confirmed just last Pentecost. So thanks be to God.
Yeah. Thanks be to God. Famous yeah. last words.
Yeah. And, you know, it was similar to me. So I was hesitant, but, I, you know, at the same time, after having been so committed to a worldview that really just kind of exploded, yeah. I really had to humble myself and I figured, you know, I clearly was so wrong before. I might as well keep my table of options open to pretty much anything here. And you're right. As I went through sort of natural theology and I really studied the arguments for the existence of God, whether we're talking about the unmoved mover or arguments for contingency or arguments from abstract objects or arguments from morality, they did seem to consistently converge on this idea of classical theism, which has always been affirmed by the church, of a God that is radically transcendent, eternal, omniscient, omnipotent, omnibenevolent, changeless, absolutely simple. And so, you know, there was this, at first, you know, you get to the God of the philosopher, but then there comes a question, well, is this God of the philosopher in any way related to or identical to the God of the Bible? Hmm. And the Catholic Church really invited me to consider that question seriously and argued that the answer to that question is actually yes. In fact, philosopher Eleanor Stump actually has a book called The God of the Philosopher and the God of the Bible, where she specifically attempts to sort of bridge that gap or really demonstrate that there was never really any gap to begin with. So that was one way into the Catholic Church. Another way, of course, was through the study of ethics, traditional natural law, and seeing how that converged with the Catholic Church as well. And then the final point of conviction was just the historical study of the church fathers and seeing, well, what did the earliest Christians really believe? Turns out they all believed in a church that was hierarchical, unified, sacramental. So between all those sort of pieces of evidence, I guess you could call them, I finally decided, Gary, that I would
swim the Tiber, huh?
Yeah, and I don't want to make it seem like it was purely intellectual either. And as much as I want to say that, like, yeah, I kind of thought my way. I mean, I really believe that it was God pulling me in the entire time. It was all the work of the Holy Spirit. And I remember at some point just kind of praying, you know, just, you know, like, God, if this is the truth, like, show me, lead me there. And I just had this pull to go to Catholic Mass on Christmas Eve one evening. Christmas Eve would be an evening, of course. And that was probably the closest thing I ever got to a mystical experience. You know, when that bell rang at the transubstantiation, I just felt something so powerful and so significant that was when the whole Catholic truth of using the head to liberate the heart and then the heart to liberate the head back again, really just, it just became cemented in me. And that, wow. And the rest, as they say, is history. And here we are. Yeah.
And thanks be to God. Yeah. You know, a lot of converts, especially those who, you know, their journey is mostly intellectual, at least at first, you know, there's always the problem of practice, you know, that needs to catch up, you know, doing Catholic things, the smells, the bells. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was your experience in this? Was that a difficult transition, or, you know, did you experiment with prayer or?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I didn't know. Yeah. I had to read books on how to do it. And my wife was very helpful because she's always been much more on the practical side. So when she became Catholic, I mean, she just went straight for the devotions, the rosaries. So just and she's great at really holding me accountable and saying, hey, we're going to start praying together. We're going to start praying the rosary at night and praying the rosary with the family and saying grace before meals and going to daily mass together. So I really have to give a lot of credit to my wife. It would have been very, very easy for me just to keep my head in the books. And that's a very dangerous, thing, because God wants you to love him. And part of that love, you know, it involves an understanding, right? You want to know about the person that you love. But there has to be that personal relationship as well. There has to be that communion through prayer, through the sacraments. So my wife really helped to push me along in that direction, hold me accountable and give me that nudge that I need, which to me only reaffirms the value of the sacrament of marriage, where you're both kind of climbing, because I definitely helped her with some of the philosophical aspects and the historical aspects, where we're both kind of climbing this mountain to God together from different angles or different sides. And we have a rubber band around each other. And as one person kind of grabs hold of a higher ledge, they automatically pull the other person up and vice versa. And I feel like that has really been the case, because by myself, I think I would have very much have fallen into that trap of just staying almost strictly. Maybe I would have prayed every now and then, you know, especially when I needed, like, God help, things like that, I believe. But I, because of my wife, I think I was able to get much, much more practically implemented much quicker.
Yeah, that's same here. I would be totally intellectual, and I don't know if it's a guy thing or what, but I'm that's how I am. But you know, you mentioned your wife. I don't know if we talked about it last program. Yeah, where was she coming from, and how did she kind of join this journey?
Yeah, so she came up in a household that was a mix of if not, you know, atheism, strong form agnosticism. And some relatives that dabbled in being spiritual but not religious. So she did not. She was never baptized. She, you know, did not grow up in a. She was in the South, interestingly enough, but she was one of the few people in North Carolina who was not Christian. Huh. And you know, she would always ask if she'd been saved, and she wouldn't know how to respond to it. So that kind of annoyed her, actually, growing up. And she developed something of an animus against Christianity. She saw it as kind of backwards. So like me, she never would have imagined that she would have become Christian or of all things Catholic. Yeah. And even though we both converted around similar times, we did kind of take a different approach, in the sense that, you know, she was asking her own questions and seeking her own answers, and I was asking mine, and we'd help each other out, and like I said, we'd fill each other's gaps. But I really feel like it wasn't just one person dragging the other person in. You know, God was kind of leading us both in our own ways, but also knowing that we were doing it together.
Yeah, yeah. So, so yours was, you know, more obviously classical theism, you know, Augustine, stuff like that. And your wife was starting to wrestle with questions about God. So. Which one was the first one to say, you know, I'm thinking this God stuff is actually true?
Yeah.
Was it you or her?
That was definitely me. and she would resist initially, but my wife is, you know, she's an incredible woman, and she's like, you know, all right, I'll read this book if you want me to read this book. And she did. And she not only became intrigued, but then started reading her own books. And one thing that was awesome. Really, if I just offer a resource for people, one thing that was really helpful to her was Bishop Barron's series, Catholicism. And the reason I think that was so helpful is not because it was intellectually heavy. And of course, it is a good, a sort of apologetic in its own right. But the series did such a good job of showing my wife the beauty and goodness of the Catholic faith. And I think that is what she needed to see the lives of the saints, to see all the good that the church has done in the world, especially when you come from a secular perspective. It's always kind of the media's whipping boy, right? Like this is everything wrong with the world. So I think for her to have seen just how good and beautiful the Catholic Church is and can be, was what really opened her up to it. So it wasn't, a deductive argument for the existence of God. I think it really was kind of the wedge of beauty that kind of cracked that initial nut in the shell.
Oh, that's interesting. So did you come in at the same time, or one of you first, then the other one followed?
Yeah, so it was an interesting situation because we were married before, so we had to get married into church. We had kids that weren't baptized, so we had to get them baptized. So we tried to do like a bulk order, if you will. But it didn't quite pan out that way. So I got in formally first. Then she got she was baptized, but then she got for reasons that aren't worth getting into. Her confirmation was delayed until just this last Pentecost.
Okay. Well, that's awesome. So, So, what a story, and really good information. And talk about great information—not just good, but great information. Well, tell us a little bit about your ministry. Chronicles of Faith, your show, your podcast.
Yeah. So, the Pat Flynn Show, like you mentioned so graciously at the beginning here, is a podcast that I run that really tries to talk about all the things that I think are good and important in life. Predominantly now, the Catholic faith and God's love. But I talk a good amount about the other areas that I've been interested in or professionally involved in, such as entrepreneurship, fitness, and so on. My professional background is in the fitness industry, so I talk a lot about kettlebells and stuff like that is my specific niche. So you'll get a mix of the physical, the mental, and the spiritual there. And I really what I found, Gary, if I can just give one more practical tip, is I want to go really deep with a lot of the sort of natural theology and because that's a lot of my background. It's always interested me. But the thing that's amazed me with the podcast is how people can just immediately open up and become receptive to religious ideas or even to Catholic faith simply by hearing that arguments even exist.
Yeah,
they don't. Yeah. I mean, like not hearing the arguments in detail, but just being able to tell people, hey, I struggled with this, and then I came to realize that God, gives a great explanation for why anything exists over nothing, or why the universe began to exist, or why we perceive moral values and duties, or why physics is fine-tuned for the emergence of intelligent interactive life, or near-death experiences, or mystical experiences, or scientifically validated miracles, and just kind of putting together a list like that for people just to. Because I think people are just so often under the assumption because of our skeptical secular culture that there just are no arguments, like not even any good ones, that there just isn't any evidence or any arguments. And so just hearing that there's at least plausibly some arguments, and according to Pat Flynn, probably some good ones, is at least enough to get people intrigued. And it's amazing how much even just kind of listing things like that can really get somebody who's at least curious, they're not actively hostile, to want to take a deeper look into things.
Very good. Well, Pat, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure, Gary. Thanks as always.
All right, Pat Flynn, check it out. Chronicles of Faith, chroniclesofstrength.com. Great stuff there. And talk about great stuff. We're going to have Brian Mercier, Catholic Brian, on the show tomorrow. And coming up next, High Impact Catholic Talk coming at you with the Terry and Jesse Show. And it's time for me to shut down the Midwest Command Center and turn off the lights here in the dojo. Well, thank everybody for listening. And I wish everybody a happy and blessed day. Bye-bye, everybody.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.